Welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. I'm Kate Dickerson. Today's episode is a conversation I had with Kristen O'Connell, an associate professor at the Jackson Laboratory. Kristen's research focuses on the effects of age on brain function and dementia risk, and her excitement and passion for this work is contagious. Kristen was one of the 5-Minute Genius speakers at this past year's Maine Science Festival. I have included a link to her talk in the show notes. Our conversation was recorded in June 2025. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Kristen, welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. It is a delight to have you. You don't know this probably, unless I told you, which I may have, that I've been, stalking you for a couple of years now and kind of keeping tabs on your research and was able to rope you into being a 5-Minute Genius speaker this year, which was great. At the festival, I really appreciated that. But before we get into kind of the really cool nitty gritty of your work, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about your background. You mentioned to me at the reception that, if I have it right, you were the first in your family to go to college. And I always find that how someone who is the first in their family, how they end up in a PhD program is wildly fascinating to me, because it's a hard path to get to. So anyway, if you want to give me just a little bit of your background and how you got into science, that'd be great.
Sure. And thank you for having me. The 5-Minute Genius experience was amazing and fantastic. I had so much fun. What a cool program. And I'm so glad that it's been going for as long as it has. And I hope it continues, because what a cool way to engage with the public and informed and educated lay audiences and give us a chance to interact with them. It was so much fun. So thank you very much for that.
I appreciate that. And next year you can come and just be in the audience and not have the pressure of a talk.
I would enjoy that. I am, in fact, the first person in my family to go to college, let alone a advanced degree program. I've actually thought about, since we had that conversation, like, how did I get into science? You know, I think as a kid, I had all the kind of normal, weird kid ideas about what I was going to be when I grow up. I can remember at various points wanting to be a farmer, wanting to be an astronaut, wanting to be a veterinarian. I really wanted to be an astronaut, and then realizing, because I wear glasses, that was probably never going to happen. I even wanted to be a lawyer at one point. But the things that like just came naturally to me, even as a kid, was science and math. Like, those were the classes I was the best at. And my family, particularly my grandparents, noticed that. And they used to give me all these books on like 101 science experiments you can do at home. And they would see things in the newspaper, you know, back when we like read newspapers and cut out these ideas, and they would give them to me. And I loved it. They bought me a microscope, and I used to look at everything under it, like just take it outside and look at anything I could find. So it was the thing I was good at. And I got a lot of encouragement to keep doing it and to explore what about it I really liked and to kind of figure out what parts of it interested me the most. I may have also been one of the first generations for whom college was almost an assumption. There was sort of that transition from being able to make a living without a 4-year degree to suddenly that was an expectation. And I think I was kind of part of that, the generation that made that transition. And so it was just natural that I would go to college and major in science. And I did. And for a lot of it, I actually kind of assumed I would go to medical school, because for a family without a lot of, you know, higher education, the natural path is to become a doctor. And at some point, I realized I did not want to be a doctor. And I was fortunate to have really great academic advisors in college. And I had opportunities to do research in a lab setting. And it was through that experience that I learned that there was this process called graduate school, where you could go and get a PhD and learn how to do science and become a scientist as a career.
So I'm curious, and I don't even know if you know the answer to this, your mentors in college, were they the first in their family to think about a PhD as well? And here's why I'm asking, just to give you some background. My husband, I think, is among certainly the first in his immediate family to go for an advanced degree. And it seemed like everybody he met in grad school had someone in their family who did that path. So for them, that seemed natural, right? Whereas the rest of us were like, what? Do you know if your mentors kind of related to you in that way?
I don't, actually. I know they were older, so it's probably a safe bet that they might have been. But no, I don't actually know if that was the case. It certainly was the case that most of my friends in college and in grad school, they came from families where both parents were college educated. They often had advanced degrees, you know, physicians, lawyers, engineers, even some college professors. I remember them being amused that I had no idea that this was a possible career path, because to them, it was just what their parents did. They grew up around it.
I mean, similar in some ways, if you think about it with theater people and sports, like often there's a through line there, right? So which through line do you grab onto? Okay, so from exploring the world outside with a microscope that your grandparents got for you to the, for me, difficult concept of thinking of proteins, you know, just as a background, I have a degree in chemistry that I barely remember. But for me, like atoms and molecules make sense. But when you start getting to proteins and cells, I am lost. So now is your opportunity to enlighten all of us about how molecules really are this cool piece of proteins and the work you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, proteins are just made up of atoms and molecules. I think one of the first things you learn in college biology, maybe even high school biology, especially these days, is this concept called the central dogma, which is that DNA, which is the kind of genetic blueprint of all of us, makes RNA, which is the sort of the message that then gets translated into proteins. The central dogma is this DNA to RNA to protein. And that sounds so nice and simple. And there's some truth to it, but it turns out that it's so much more complicated than that, and that every one of those steps has countless individual intermediate steps that each themselves can be regulated, and there are feedback mechanisms that make sure that the system just sort of has what it needs, no more, no less. And that's one of the foundational principles of cell biology. How do you get a protein, which of course is the thing that makes everything work? Cells are made up of proteins and lipids. And the DNA and the RNA contain the instructions for how to make those proteins, but those proteins have to be made. And that's a whole big, long, complicated process that involves a lot of molecules and a lot of pathways, some of which we understand very well, and some of which we're only just beginning to understand, because in science, technology often drives what we can know. So the more advanced or the more specific that our technology gets, the greater the resolution we can investigate something and interrogate a system, the more we learn about it. And I think for a long time, we've had that technology in the DNA and RNA space. We can sequence those things. They're amenable. That's the way they're built. They evolve to be copied and read off. And they're actually quite simple, right? There are only four bases of DNA and there are four bases of RNA. And it's relatively simple. And then protein gets so much more complicated. There are 20 amino acids and several dozen ways to encode each one of those amino acids. And they can go together in all kinds of different ways. And sometimes it's not the sequence, it's the way it's put together and the structure that it adopts. That whole process I just find fascinating. And understanding how all that happens. How does a cell end up with the complement of protein that it needs to have to perform its function? It just fascinates me. And I'm interested in it, somehow grew up to become a neuroscientist, which in some ways I still can't explain other than I found the brain fascinating. So understanding that in the context of the brain and cognition and the way neurons function and talk to each other and make these circuits that are just the basis of how we think and who we are. They're how we learn, how we remember things, how we form memories and recall memories. And underlying all of those things are proteins. And lipids, which don't get nearly as much attention, but should.
Okay, and now's your time. Hit it.
Yeah, I think lipids are one of those areas where technology's been a bottleneck. Because lipids are not direct products of genes, right? They're the products of all these biosynthetic pathways that are made up of proteins. And you know, I think one place I was going with the like DNA and RNA are relatively easy to measure is that protein is not. Protein sequencing is actually quite challenging. Protein's hard to amplify because it's just the unique thing that you have to take one step back to RNA to figure out, and that isn't always one-to-one. And so now when you go one level up to lipids, it gets even more complicated. And lipids are incredibly abundant, at least in the context of the brain. More than half the brain is made up of lipids. And the simplest way of talking about them is that lipids make up fat, right? They're fatty acids. But they also are responsible for the structure of our cells. Every cell in our body is actually made of lipid. And without lipid, there wouldn't be a cell. It's what separates the inside of the cell from the extracellular, kind of the rest of the environment. So cells are important for structure. They're important signaling molecules. They get turned into these incredibly important and, in many cases, really well-described signaling molecules that are ways that cells, including neurons, talk, like communicate within a cell, but then between cells. And obviously, they're an energy source. It's probably the way most people appreciate them, because they are. They are a way of storing energy, and they're a way of using energy. But they're so much more complicated than that, and been very challenging, because since they're not the direct product of a gene, it's more challenging to manipulate them. We can't add tags to them that let us follow them through cells the way we can for protein. We don't have antibodies to lipids. It's funny, in biology, when you can't see something, it's actually really difficult to study it. Being able to see it and visualizing it is really important. And modifications that we did make to lipids, maybe to add like a fluorescent tag to it, they often change then what the lipid does, because you're fundamentally changing this molecule. It's a lipid. It's not an amino acid. It's not a protein. It's not a nucleic acid. Every part of that lipid plays a role. And when you modify that, you change what it does. So it's an interesting time to be in biology, because there are these now advances in a technique called mass spectrometry that allow us to visualize lipids. They allow us to measure them directly without having to label them, without having to have them tagged or even know anything about them at all. We can measure what they are, where they are, and have this whole new view of what lipids do and how they contribute to biology and the structure and function of the brain.
So for the mass spec, I assume it's a resolution issue. Like, we finally have enough higher resolution that you can see the lipids. This is a super basic question, but how do you know that the lipid you're looking at in one mass spec is the same as one in the next one?
That's a good question. Most of it is based on the principles of mass spectrometry. So in modern mass specs, you have a laser, it ionizes a sample, and as the ions come off, they give off a very characteristic spectra. And it's that spectra that tells us what that lipid is. Where the field of lipidomics, which is now just the next iteration of the greater omics universe, is a little bit behind, but is rapidly catching up, is kind of, I think, to your point of having the standards that tell us that this spectra matches this lipid. But that is rapidly getting filled in. And so now we know with high confidence the spectra and annotation of probably close to 500 lipids. And we think that there are many, many more.
So this is like decades ago when people were first using mass spec to figure out what an ethanol molecule looked like almost. And you're cataloging it so that you can then figure out what's in a system.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. I mean, it's built on decades of research and decades of data collection. And to build these libraries and these databases that you can take the spectra and the information that's coming off the instrument and compare it to, and then say, well, this looks like this. And so therefore, it's most likely this. It is amazing, quite frankly, to think about the way it works and what it does. And now to appreciate the advances in that technology that give us both incredible molecular resolution. So really going down into very small molecules and being able to know what those are with confidence, but also now spatial resolution. So we can now do mass spec on an intact tissue and know where in that tissue a given molecule is, whether it's a protein or a lipid. And we're down to about 10 micron spatial resolution, which is the single cell. And that will get better. I believe there's already technology to come down to 5 microns. So it won't be long before we're probably getting at least very close to submicron resolution. I think that's possible, and it will likely happen at least within the next decade.
Okay, so you're a neuroscientist. You're looking at the brain. I assume you're not just doing basic research to figure out lipids for the sake of figuring out lipids.
No, although I wish I could just do basic research to figure out something for the sake of figuring it out. And in some ways we do.
Yeah, I mean, I said that a little cavalierly, and I know there's an end goal that you're also looking at. And then that was not to be dismissive of basic research. I actually think it's critically important, but I also know that's not the only thing you're doing here.
No, but it is that basic research forms the foundation of understanding how things work so we can understand why they don't work, when they don't work. And a big chunk of my research program is interested in the effects of age on how the brain works and how it influences risk for developing dementia, which includes Alzheimer's disease and dementias related to AD. And the focus on lipids is really because we know that a lot of the genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease, right? Like probably the one most people have heard of is a gene called, or it's also a protein called ApoE. Which isoform of ApoE you're carrying influences your risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. Most people carry what's called ApoE3, which is considered the neutral variant. If you are an ApoE4 carrier, that increases your risk 50 to 200%. Now, it's important to say we're talking about risk. It's not a guarantee. It's simply increasing your risk for developing the disease, not guaranteeing that you will develop it. And the reason I put this in the context of ApoE is that ApoE is what's called a lipoprotein. It is a protein that binds to lipids. So while we understand its protein function, we understand what it does and how it influences the lipids in the brain much less. We know that it acts as a carrier for cholesterol, but somehow it influences other lipids as well. And understanding how this genetic risk for AD influences the lipidome, which then in turn influences the way the brain works, because the brain is made of lipid. We actually don't even know. We don't have a good sense of how that itself impacts your risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. We don't understand how it impacts how your brain will age. We know that the lipidome changes with age, but we don't know how. We don't know why that happens. And we don't know if certain parts of the brain are more vulnerable to those changes than others. Are there regions that we should be paying more attention to? The white matter in your brain, which is what allows the regions of your brain to communicate with one another, is made up largely of lipids, of fat. And there is white matter loss in aging, and particularly with Alzheimer's disease. We don't really understand why. And so understanding all of the changes, like what makes up the lipid composition of an individual's brain, what maintains it, and then what leads it to breakdown. Because as it breaks down, cellular integrity breaks down, signaling breaks down, the structure breaks, like synapses, everything kind of falls apart. That's the reason we're interested in the lipids of the brain. What does it tell us about an individual's risk or resilience to the effects of cognitive aging, going on to develop Alzheimer's or other dementia or Parkinson's disease? So many of these diseases actually have genetic factors that are associated with lipids or lipid metabolism and biosynthesis. And that's really poorly understood.
So this seems to me, it goes back to what you said a few minutes ago when we were talking, which is if you put something in a lipid, it changes its function.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a similar idea with whatever the genetic prevalence is? That is how the lipids are being impacted, possibly, and you're trying to figure out exactly what it is that's doing that with each one? Or is that too simple?
No, actually, that's pretty much spot on. Using the mass spec, we've been able to look at lipids in the brain and in specific parts of the brain, because we now have the resolution to be able to do this spatially. And we've seen lipids where the addition of a single carbon to the fatty acid tail, like making it go from having 17 carbons to 18 carbons, means that we only see it in the brains of male mice, but not female mice. Maybe the 17 carbon version is in female mice, the 18 carbon version is in male mice. And they're exclusive. One is not in the other. The same goes for the number of double bonds. So like a saturated versus unsaturated fatty acids, which probably a lot of people have heard of and are familiar with in the sense of dietary fat. The same principle applies to the fatty acids that make up your brain and other tissues. So how many double bonds are in those fatty acid tails? The same thing kind of applies. That one double bond more means that we see a lipid only in one part of the brain, but not another. It completely changes the distribution. So some of these changes they're biologically meaningful differences between one lipid species and another, have profound impact on where that lipid is, who we find it in, and presumably that has an impact on function. So my goal is to figure out how does that, for example, influence the risk of males versus females. In the Alzheimer's context, females are at higher risk. Does understanding the impact of biological sex on the brain lipidome help us understand why females are at higher risk? Keeping in mind that all the steroid hormones, which includes the sex hormones, are derived from lipids. Their precursors are lipids.
This is just really mind-blowing to me. First of all, the ability to see that kind of distinction, like to actually measure it, and then trying to figure out, there's so much that's not known, right? Like this seems like just a huge frontier to me. Have you seen either in your lab or with other researchers something that was so surprising that it changed how you looked at the work you're doing continuing on? And I'm not entirely sure what I mean by that question, but it seems like from an outsider perspective, there could be revelations every week. But has there been something where you were like, I did not see that one coming?
I have to say, I think the first data we got back from the lipid imaging on the mass spec, where like most scientists, we had done a pilot feasibility study that was just in one mouse, male, young, that's just the way everybody does. It's the highest chance of success. We had expanded that to different ages from a very young mouse, about 4 months old, to a very old mouse at about 26 months old. So just over 2 years. And we had done both sexes. And when we looked at the data and we're comparing side by side, seeing that here are lipids that are exclusively in males, and here are lipids that are exclusively in females, and here are lipids that are exclusively in subcortical regions or exclusively in the hippocampus, but not just exclusively in the hippocampus, exclusively one small subregion of the hippocampus. It was seeing that we could define the entire anatomical structure of the brain using only lipid information was this moment for me of like, I thought I understood the complexity of the brain, or at least I was starting to get a handle on it. And now I have no idea. And that was actually a really cool feeling of looking at something and having a moment of, at this moment, right now, I am the only person in the world who knows this. That was really cool. It's like part of the reason you get in and stay in science is those kind of discoveries of like, this is a fundamental principle of biology that we had no idea existed.
You know, before we started recording, you and I were both talking about how much we don't want video for these podcast conversations. And right now, the only thing that's making me question that is like your whole face lighting up that I'm the only one that gets to experience it. But that was awesome. So this is maybe a little bit of a segue, but not a direct one, but we've been talking about the mass spec and how critically important that is. It's really interesting to me because it's really important for basic science. I mean, I remember back in the dark ages when I was doing my chemistry degree, we had some mass spec that we could use that I could vaguely remember that we learned how to use it. And it was nowhere near, I'm sure, what you've got. But two things. Number one, the amount of engineering that goes into that. So the deep dependence you have on other scientific fields and research fields and engineering. I don't want to dive into that, but I just want to acknowledge like no one is here in a vacuum, right? There's just so much other, the physics and the chemistry and all of that is critically important. But I do know that if I have it correctly, you were able to get this first of its kind in Maine and in the United States mass spec because of funding from the National Institutes for Health. And that leads into a conversation we were also having about how important it is for science to have basic research and have funding from the government, because there's things that it doesn't make sense to do on a profit model or a foundation model funding. Like you just need to have basic research to advance what we know. And really the only people who choose to do that are people who their skin in the game is, we just want to know more. And that is in our system, the general public, by virtue of people who've decided that knowing more about the world around us is a good thing. So speaking just for you, if you could talk a little bit about how important it is to have the opportunity to have funding for this type of research tool and what that means in the context of kind of broader science funding in general.
Yeah, with the caveat that my opinions here are just my own. The thing about basic science is we never know what we're going to find and when it's going to be important. And being able to do basic science and explore things that we find and be able to follow up with the interesting ones and the important ones, most of the time you can't know going into something whether or not that's important. It's being able to do it kind of free of that bias and being able to interact with other scientists and engineers. Like, these mass specs have applications for lots of things, not just biology. And that's really important because innovation in one area drives innovation in other areas, and you often can't predict how that's going to happen. It has to happen, and then the world has to know about it. And often when I say the world, I really mean like science world.
Fair enough.
Well, it's to see a technology developed for chemistry, right? Because the first mass specs were developed as tools for chemistry. And now today, we use them for all kinds of applications, but it was seeing this instrument, this tool being used and realizing, hey, that has an application to my work. How much slower would everything have moved if we'd had to wait to independently discover that rather than having this interaction? Because everybody's funded by the public, everything we do is really, truly for the greater good of the public, of the citizens who pay the taxes that pay for all of this. We, for the most part, do it for them. And it's being able to explore ideas and figure out what's interesting. How does this work? What does it tell us about why something doesn't work? But you have to have the freedom to just explore rather than having an idea of, well, I think it should be this. Because very often it's not that. And that's actually like anathema to most scientists to think that way, because that's bias. And that's how you end up with, shall we say, erroneous results that are difficult to reproduce by other people. Whereas if you kind of do it almost from a bottom-up perspective of, I don't really know what I'm going to find, but I'm going to look everywhere. And I'm not going to go into it with a preconceived idea of what the answer should be. Those are the most robust things that are reproducible. Almost anyone can do them anywhere. And they translate fastest into real measurable benefits to humans and human health.
This is when I say, I could talk to you for hours and we could go down this rabbit hole of lipids and ingesting fat and how much that impacts your brain and all of these other things that I'm sure you've thought of, but I don't think it would be fair to take up your time doing all of that. Unless you have like a really quick answer to that, I would like to hold that in check for the next time you and I talk and I rope you into giving me a little bit of your time. But I will say, I do think it's super interesting to think about. There's this part of our body that's so incredibly important that we are only just now realizing we know so little about. And I think we've all kind of thought about the brain and how little we know about it, but I have not thought about how little we know about what makes up the brain, the lipids part, until I heard you talk in March, right? And I was like, gosh, that's a, no pun intended, a total no-brainer. How did I not put that together? Like, how cool is that? So it was really fascinating, which is why I want to talk to you a little bit more in depth about it. And I appreciate your work on this, and I appreciate your deep, deep enthusiasm. I'm going to put a link to your talk, the 5-Minute Genius talk, in the show notes. You do a really great job in that, I think, explaining the difference between normal aging and serious brain issues with dementia and other things, which we did not get into here. And I kind of purposely didn't get into it because I knew we had that. But I'm so grateful for the work you're doing and your advocacy for helping explain why it's so important that we fund science.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and the platform and the forum to have this. I think as scientists, we have an obligation to explain what we do to the public who's paying us, and maybe we could do a better job of that. So thank you for the platform to be able to do that. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Maine Science Podcast. Make sure you never miss an episode by following us on your podcast platform of choice. And please leave a rating and review. It will help more people find us and help spread the word about some of the remarkable people doing science in Maine. The Maine Science Podcast is recorded at Discovery Studios at the Maine Discovery Museum in Bangor, Maine. The Maine Science Podcast is executive produced and hosted by me, Kate Dickerson, and edited and produced by Scott Lozell. And the Discover Maine theme was composed and performed by Nick Parker.